Due to the graphic nature of this spy's life and crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of violence, war, and sexuality that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. Dushko Popov hung up the payphone, palms slick with sweat. It was November of 1940. World War II had been raging for just a little over a year, and Popov had already spent several weeks ingratiating himself with the Nazi spy network. The call had gone smoothly, but that didn't mean everything else would. Exiting the phone booth, Popov made his way to the pickup point outside a bustling Lisbon cafe. He waited there and tried to collect himself. He couldn't let them see his nerves. Just cool charm. Within the hour, a blonde woman walked by and winked. Popov felt his natural instincts jump into play. He winked back. Then, he followed her to a waiting car and hopped in. The car sped off, up the Cerulean coast to a villa along the cliffs, where Popov would meet Major Ludovico von Kostov, his Nazi handler. 4 years later, in 1944, Kostov would throw a dinner party celebrating Popov's achievements for the German cause. Little did Kostov know that through all their time working together in Nazi counterintelligence, Popov had been making moves against him. He was a double agent for MI6, MI5, and the FBI. Codename, Tricycle. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This is our first episode on Serbian double agent Dushko Popov, who passed off disinformation to Germany while working for MI6, MI5, and the FBI. His story, full of intrigue, murder, and sex appeal, is one of the inspirations behind Ian Fleming's James Bond. This week, we'll explore how Popov was recruited by both Germany's Abwehr and Britain's MI6, cementing himself as one of World War II's foremost double agents, and how promptly after he started his life as a spy, he was given information that could have stopped Pearl Harbor. Next week, in Part 2, we'll follow Popov's crucial role in helping save the Allied forces on D-Day. In February of 1940, 27-year-old Dushko Popov returned home to Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia for the St. Blaise Festival. He traveled down from Belgrade, where he had been working as a lawyer for the past few years. It was a familiar trip. Born into the ranks of a wealthy Yugoslavian family, Popov had grown up spending his winters in Belgrade and summers in Dubrovnik. But the events that would follow this time were far less routine. After a night of festival debauchery, Popov woke to his chamberwoman pulling open the blinds and handing him a telegram. It was from Johann Jebsen, urging Popov to meet him in 4 days' time at the Hotel Serbian King in Belgrade. Johann, who was unusually calm and collected, sounded uncharacteristically frantic in his telegram. His tone worried Popov. Something serious was afoot. His vacation would have to be put on hold. Racing his BMW down the long road to Belgrade, Popov speculated about what kind of trouble Johann, or Johnny as he called him, had gotten into. It wouldn't be the first time the best friends saw each other through a tight spot. Their story went all the way back to 1935. Popov had just finished his law degree in Belgrade and was pursuing a doctorate at Freiburg University in Germany. That's where he met fellow well-to-do bad boy Johann Jebsen, Johnny, at the university's Ausländer Club. The two young men instantly hit it off. Popov wrote in his autobiography that they were both addicted to sports cars and sporting girls, and had enough money to keep them both running. They were also both charming and clever. But while Johnny's intelligence ran cold and calculated, Popov's ran hot and impulsive. During his time at Freiburg, Popov would often make public speeches, engaging in lively political debates. He distrusted authority and was known for stirring up fights. Trouble, and the attention it brought, had a way of following him. The worst of it came knocking one morning in 1937, soon after Popov finished his doctorate. Half-dressed and groggy from the night before, he opened his door to find 4 Gestapo agents. He was ordered to dress and follow them at once. For 8 days and nights, the Gestapo agents relentlessly questioned Popov. He was suspected of being a communist sympathizer. The suspicion was founded on a pro-democracy speech he had given a few days before. The Gestapo went on to accuse Popov of going out with a factory girl and hanging around the factory, to which Popov is alleged to have responded, "In Dubrovnik, we have an ancient tradition of democracy. Bootblacks and lords associate with each other, attending the same school and remaining on familiar terms even after. Yes, I came to pick up the girl, if you want to call that hanging around a factory." The Gestapo agents pressed further, demanding, "Admit it, you're a communist." To which Popov quipped, "I'm not a Nazi, if that's what you mean." The interrogation continued on in this manner over the course of 8 days. By Popov's own account, 200 people were interviewed in the Gestapo's case against him, but only 2 people stood up for him, one of whom was dear old Johnny. Johnny had also sent word of the whole affair to Popov's father in Dubrovnik, who in turn asked the Yugoslav Prime Minister, Dr. Stojadinovich, to intervene in the matter. He did, and Popov was immediately freed, on the condition that he leave Germany within 24 hours. Popov was happy to oblige. The whole affair had only exacerbated his already low opinion of the Nazis. The coming years didn't improve it either. After leaving Freiburg, Popov set up a law practice in Belgrade, where he watched the Nazi Party's continued rise from a safe distance. When World War II broke out in September of 1939, Popov was not all that surprised. He'd known the Nazis' ambitions were destructive and relentless. But he wasn't too worried for himself. In Belgrade and all across Europe, he had started forging connections with the businesses and political elite. These were the kind of folks who could help him get out of Belgrade if the war hit his hometown. There were even Germans amongst his contacts, including the Belgrade embassy's undersecretary. But Secretary von Stein had his own plans for Popov. Noting his charm and connections, von Stein tried to recruit him into working for the Nazis. Popov flatly refused. Why should he work for a country that wrongfully arrested him and a political party he disagreed with? Plus, he was happy living out his cosmopolitan life as a business lawyer. But on February 4th, 1940, 3 years after he was expelled from Germany, Johnny's urgent telegram changed everything. Popov arrived at the Serbian King Hotel to a changed Johnny. He was haggard, nervously drinking and smoking, and he only looked more anxious as he told Popov the reason for their meeting. The truth was, he was working for the Abwehr, the intelligence service of Nazi Germany. The news came as a shock to Popov, but he hesitated to judge his friend. He knew that German men didn't have many options if they wanted to avoid being branded as traitors. Johnny's story, joining the Abwehr to avoid being conscripted by the military, was a familiar one. But by the end of their meeting, Johnny's confession morphed into a request. Setting down his drink, Johnny looked straight into Popov's eyes and asked him to join the Abwehr. By no means did Popov support the Nazis, but he did feel somewhat indebted to his friend. What's more, he knew just how insistent the Abwehr could be with potential recruits, thanks to Secretary von Stein's tenacious overtures. It was a difficult spot to be in. But as it turns out, the Abwehr weren't the only intelligence operation keeping an eye on him. After his meeting with Johnny, Popov was summoned to the British Embassy in Belgrade by George Lethbridge, MI6 station chief. Lethbridge didn't reveal the agency's reasons for summoning him. He started in by questioning Popov about his most recent whereabouts. Popov sat still for a moment, considering. He was all too aware that Lethbridge was playing a game here, and the games of secret agents were dangerous. Plus, he valued his independence, but he seemed to be stuck in the crosshairs of the Allied and Axis powers. And if he was going to work for one side, he knew where his allegiance lay. It didn't take long before Popov made a choice that would define the rest of his life. He told Lethbridge about his connections to both Johnny and von Stein, and about their efforts to recruit him into German counterintelligence. Lethbridge was delighted. This was exactly what he'd been hoping to hear. Popov was in the perfect spot to infiltrate the Abwehr and to test how far the Nazis' trust would take him as a double agent. Playing both sides was sure to be a precarious balancing act, but the idea was starting to excite Popov. He did love a challenge, and he might just have the brazen self-assurance to pull it off. In the fall of 1940, Popov's initiation into Nazi counterintelligence was mediated by Johnny Jebsen, Secretary von Stein, and the British Embassy. When the Abwehr tasked him with filling out a questionnaire about British military operations, Popov went to his British Embassy contact to coordinate the answers. According to the Spy Museum, this type of intel is referred to as chicken feed. Chicken feed is genuine but not seriously damaging intelligence knowingly provided to an enemy intelligence agency through an agent or a double agent to establish his bona fides. The Nazis accepted Popov's answers, not knowing that what they were getting was British-sanctioned fodder. In November of 1940, Johnny's Abwehr supervisor met with Popov to officially welcome him aboard as a Nazi spy, codename Ivan. The supervisor emphasized that while the risks of the work would be significant, so would the pay. Popov would receive compensation as soon as he began his first mission, to England. There, he'd collect information from potential new informants, and prove his worth as a spy. But while Popoff was busy preparing for a life of espionage, somebody had started spying on him. One November night in 1940, Johnny burst into Popoff's room, waving a set of papers and proclaiming, "You're being sold out." The culprit was none other than Popoff's longtime chauffeur, Bozidar. Bozidar had been paid handsomely by the Abwehr to track and record Popoff's every move, most of which were to his girlfriend's houses. But Johnny noticed that one particular series of trips stood out: Popoff's 6 visits to the British Embassy's passport control, which everyone knew was a front for MI6. Popoff couldn't let this betrayal go without retaliation. And he couldn't let Bozidar keep walking free, feeding even more information to the enemy, compromising his own safety. Luckily, thanks to his work as a lawyer, Popoff was well-connected with the criminal underworld. He recruited the help of 2 shadowy clients he'd represented in the past and asked them to take care of Bozidar. They did. Bozidar's murder would be the first of several linked back to Popoff. He would later justify the murders as necessary evils in the face of war. But eliminating Bozidar didn't eliminate the problem. Johnny now knew of Popoff's visits to British intelligence. His life now rested in his old friend's hands. Coming up, Popoff's double dealings put him at risk of exposure at every turn. And now, back to the story. In November of 1940, it looked like 28-year-old Dushko Popoff's cover was blown before it had even had the chance to take shape. Johnny Yepsen knew that he had been secretly meeting with British intelligence, after promising his allegiance to the Nazi intelligence service, the Abwehr. But in addition to being a reluctant Abwehr agent, Johnny was Popoff's best friend. He knew where his real loyalties lay. He decided to help falsify a report that made it look like nothing was amiss. This marked the beginning of Johnny and Popoff's unspoken partnership in undermining the Abwehr. And the show was just getting started. In December of 1940, Popoff, or Scoot, as MI6 would call him, met his British handler, Lethbridge, in a park outside of Belgrade. Lethbridge talked him through what to expect on his upcoming trip to London. He advised Popoff to act as if you are a real German spy and forget you belong to us. While traveling, look as though you are worried that the English may suspect you. You can be sure the Germans will be observing you at every moment. But Popoff wouldn't be going straight to London. First, he'd stop in Lisbon, Portugal, where he'd be vetted by his would-be handler, Major Ludovico von Kastoff. Von Kastoff was the chief of the Lisbon desk, and a likable man, according to Johnny. If Popoff and von Kastoff's meeting proved a success, then the trip to England was a go. In the meantime, Portugal would be the perfect espionage playground for a fun-loving man like Popoff. Lisbon was the bustling hub of neutral Europe. Unlike the rest of the continent, Portugal had no rationing and a more laissez-faire attitude when it came to the dueling interests of the Germans and British. Wealthy civilians, soldiers, and spies of all nationalities came to Lisbon to relax on the beach, place bets in the casino, or discuss international secrets in one of the city's many hotel bars. Popoff's first stop would be a villa up the coast from the city, called Toki Ona, where he would meet his Nazi spy master for the first time. It was a high-stakes meeting. If Major von Kastoff sniffed out Popoff's duplicity, the game was up. But just as Johnny had predicted, Popoff and von Kastoff got along instantly. Von Castoff was smart and charming. Popoff saw a lot of himself in the older man, and the major felt the same way. Still, it was a strain for Popoff to lie to a man he liked. And although the major was pleasant, he was also terrifying. In Popoff's words, spending time with Von Castoff was like being in the company of a domesticated panther. At any moment, Popoff could be devoured. After their first meeting, Popoff needed to rest and figure out his next steps around the sleeping beast. But the hotel the Abwehr had set him up in did not prove to be restful. On his third night at the Avis, Popoff emerged from the shower to find a stranger in his room, a woman in a silk negligee. She walked over and kissed Popoff before introducing herself as Elena, and she wanted to know more about him. Starting with his political opinions and ending with his reason for being in Portugal. It was clear to Popoff that Elena was a spy, and as much as he loved women, he was not about to fall into the first trap that came his way. So he lied, keeping his cover. He was in Lisbon to help a client find some post-impressionist paintings. Then he sent her on her way. Still, it was a near miss. Popoff knew he had to switch hotels if he was going to be comfortable in Lisbon. The Axis presence was overwhelming here. So, with the approval of Von Castoff, he changed over to the more ally-friendly Palacio. Citing the hotel's better entertainment options as the reason for the move, he simply needed a casino and access to the beach. When it came to a lively young man like Popoff, such a request went unquestioned. A few weeks after the move, late in December of 1940, Popoff's British visa was finally approved. Von Castoff met with him to run through his mission. Popoff was supposed to recruit members of the British political and military elite who might switch sides and aid the Germans. He was expected to relay this information through a new secret ink formula. According to historian Christy McCrackis, World War II spurred new developments in invisible ink technologies, including the formula Popoff would use. When sending messages back to his Nazi spy masters, Popoff would first dissolve a few crystals in a glass full of non-chlorinated water. Then, he would use the solution and a steel nib to write his message, sending it via postcard to one of several secret addresses in Lisbon. Finally, Von Castoff would receive it and, placing a hot iron on the card, reveal the encoded message. Invisible ink in hand, Popoff was off to England. This would be his first real test to prove himself to his Nazi handlers. Upon arrival in London, Popoff was ushered by an agent into an Aston Martin. However, the agent escorting him didn't work for the Nazis. No, in fact, he was MI5. The Aston Martin zipped through London's gray streets, driven by a chauffeur who, in another life, had been a trophy-winning race car driver. They arrived at the Savoy Hotel in no time at all. Like the other hotels that Popoff was accustomed to, the Savoy was considered one of Europe's most luxurious. Room 430 was no exception to the standard, but Popoff's new British handler, Major Tar Robertson, put a damper on the elegant mood. Over the next few days, along with other senior members of the 20 Committee, interviewed Popoff for the job of double agent. Despite his code name, gifted back in Belgrade, he wasn't apparently quite in yet. The 20 Committee, famously referred to as the Double Cross Committee, was a joint effort between MI5 and MI6 to merge intelligence and counterintelligence under the same bureaucratic roof. In vetting Popoff, the committee members were trying to decide whether or not they could trust him in the long term. It didn't take long for them to officially pull him into their ranks. Popoff was terribly likable. Well, not only was he charming, but he was also undeniably qualified. He spoke 5 languages, had multiple degrees, and had all the right contacts to maneuver his way through Allied and Axis circles. And his strategic position within the Abwehr was too good to pass up. After his official indoctrination into the Double Cross system, Popoff's new British handlers invited him to a New Year's Eve party to celebrate. Drink in hand, Popoff held court among Britain's political and military elite. Amongst them was Major General Stuart Mingus, otherwise known as C. Mingus was the head of MI6 and the second most important man in Britain, preceded only by Winston Churchill. On the eve of 1941, Popoff pulled C aside, and the two men immediately hit it off. Towards the end of their conversation, C gave Popoff a piece of advice he wouldn't soon forget. "You have too many devices on your banner. You may have the makings of a very good spy, except that you don't like to obey orders. You had better learn, or you will be a very dead spy." Coming up, Popoff's cover threatens to unravel. And now back to the story. By January of 1941, Dushko Popoff was officially working for both German and British intelligence. The Abwehr had sent him to England to recruit British assets, and the British provided them in spades. His British handler, Major Robertson, introduced him to 2 key contacts: Dickie Metcalf, an MI5 officer with military intel, and Friedel Gartner, an Austrian woman with British political connections. Popoff would present Friedel and Dickie to von Castorf to the Abwehr as informants. In reality, they too would be working for Britain's Double Cross Committee. Popoff was officially in charge of 2 other double agents, and he got a new code name as a result: Tricycle. Some historians have suggested a much racier reason for Popoff's change in codename: his supposed fondness for threesomes. Although this suggestion isn't more than speculative, it's not all that far-fetched, given Popoff's reputation as a playboy. In almost every city where he worked, he had 2 or 3 girlfriends, including Friedel, his new sub-agent. But back in Germany, Popoff was still on assignment under the codename Ivan, too. Using his invisible ink, he sent encrypted postcards to von Castorf, assuring him that he had successfully started his own spy network in London with 2 new sub-agents. The German major was duly satisfied. He ordered Popoff to return to Portugal in March of 1941. The war was heating up by this point, and an increasing number of Nazi atrocities were coming to light, including a bombing of Popoff's home, Belgrade. Popoff took the news with anger and anxiety for his family. He'd always known since his university days that Nazis were not to be trusted, however charming some members of the party seemed to be. But he had to brush away the emotion. This was just another reason to remain calm, cool, and committed to his mission. It also gave him more reason to take advantage of his job perks at the Nazis' expense. He started spending a good deal of time and money at the Casino Estoril. Popoff once said of his indulgent lifestyle, "Why not? If the Germans are paying for it, and that life is me. If I didn't live it, I would be blown. The Germans would realize at once that there was something strange. Although Popov makes a decent point, it was that same decadent lifestyle that kept nearly blowing the cover he was trying to protect. Situated along the Portuguese Riviera, the Casino Estoril was the premier destination for many of Europe's young and wealthy, even during the war. It also happened to be a hotbed of espionage. It was there that Ian Fleming, working for MI6 at the time, witnessed the smooth charisma of Dushko Popov, which would later partly inspire Fleming's James Bond character. The covert affairs at the Casino Estoril, meanwhile, would be the inspiration behind Casino Royale. In this case, real life was certainly more dramatic than fiction. One humid night in 1941, while Popov was out with one of his many girlfriends, he nearly lost everything, his cover and his life. Seated in the casino's nightclub, he watched as a drunk American woman took to the stage in an attempt to sing. She wasn't very good. Thinking it'd be funny, Popov asked a waiter to send a single cork to the woman, essentially communicating, "Put a cork in it." The woman immediately took offense, but no more so than her male companions, who barreled their way towards Popov and his date. In a matter of seconds, they would be upon him, and perhaps find both the British and German notes he had hidden away in his pockets, outing him as a double agent. Thinking quick, Popov slipped his notes into his date's purse and asked her to run ahead. She bolted from the casino just as the singer's friends reached Popov. He fought them off and dashed to find his date. He searched all over the casino's grounds, but the woman was nowhere to be found, until he heard a scream. Within seconds, he found his date and her assailant wrestling for the purse. He swiftly knocked the man out cold, securing the purse and its contents, in effect, recovering the keys to his secret life. It wasn't long before he was back in the driver's seat, ready to go wherever his spy masters needed him next. After the success of the spy network Popov had supposedly set up in Britain, the Abwehr was confident that he could do the same elsewhere. So, in the fall of 1941, Major von Kastoff told Popov that the Abwehr were sending him to the United States, where he would need to build up a new, more elaborate spy network. MI6, meanwhile, promptly prepared to loan out Popov to the Americans. He would help them set up a counterintelligence branch of their own at the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. In preparing the Americans for Popov's arrival, the head of MI6, otherwise known as C, made sure to relay the particularities of Popov's character to Hoover, namely his playboy lifestyle. Since Popov would be in the U.S. on the German dime, the Americans didn't have to worry about supporting his lavish way of life. They just had to accept it. Still, Hoover was less than enthused to have to cater to Popov's flamboyant whims. The Abwehr, meanwhile, had their own expectations for the trip. Popov was sent to gather intelligence on U.S. military and political strategies, and particularly details on the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The stakes were high on both ends. In August of 1941, Popov packed up his things for the mission of a lifetime. Among his belongings were all the trappings of a spy, including his questionnaire of desired intel, secret ink, and several micro dots. According to data historians Nihad Ahmad Hassan and Rami Hijazi, microdots are text or images that are shrunken down to the size of a 1 millimeter dot. Microdots were one of the more popular encryption methods used throughout World War II by both Allied and Axis counterintelligence agencies. Because they were so small, they were perfect for delivering messages without detection. And the information that Popov already had entering the United States turned out to be more valuable than the Americans, or even Popov himself, could have ever foreseen. Popov arrived in New York on August 12, 1941. Upon arrival, Popov knew that the Axis powers were planning something big for Pearl Harbor. The particularities of his mission suggested as much. Adamant that something was afoot, he immediately took this information to his MI6 handler in New York, Dick Ellis, who was overseeing Popov's dealings with the FBI. The two met with the FBI's assistant director, Earl Connolly, at the Commodore Hotel. Popov explained Germany and Japan's interest in Pearl Harbor's defenses. Connolly was duly alarmed. He sent a letter to Hoover immediately, attaching the questionnaire Popov had been given by the Germans. That is to say, the FBI received warning of a possible attack on Pearl Harbor 4 months before it would actually happen. What did they do with this information? Nothing. Part of the problem was that Hoover didn't trust Popov, or any foreign intelligence operative for that matter. In fact, Hoover had secretly backed a bill that would have limited the efforts of non-American agents working in the United States. It wasn't just that Popov and spies like him rubbed Hoover the wrong way. It was also that he didn't want foreign intelligence agencies sapping his funding and authority on American soil. He was so mistrustful that he even had Popov surveilled throughout the duration of his stay in New York. Popov, accustomed to being followed by now, was well aware of this. Clearly, there was no trust here, so Popov kept his guard up around the American agents who were meant to be running him. Turns out, he had every reason to do so. Popov's Nazi handlers expected him to travel to Hawaii to gain intel about Pearl Harbor. But Hoover blocked Popov's planned trip to the naval base. This change in plans threatened Popov's cover. And for the rest of Popov's time in the U.S., the FBI would continue to sideline him from the espionage game he was meant to be playing alongside them. A couple months into his American tour, with little to do, Popov traveled to Miami with his American girlfriend, Terry Richardson. He hoped to take a small vacation from the FBI's bureaucratic politics and incessant surveillance. But, of course, FBI agents followed him and Terry to their resort. One moment, Popov was tanning on the beach. The next, he was being questioned by G-Men. It seemed that he had violated the Mann Act, which made it a felony to transport any woman or girl for the purpose of prostitution, debauchery, or any other immoral purpose across state lines. The FBI was undermining Popov's every move. And on December 7, 1941, they'd pay for their misjudgment when Japanese forces attacked Pearl Harbor. Over the next several years, there were to be 8 investigations into the FBI intelligence failures that led to Pearl Harbor. None of them mentioned Dushko Popov. It wasn't until 1971, when Popov's questionnaire became declassified, that the general public found out about the FBI's foolish, deadly mistake. Back in 1941, Popov's life as a spy was looking bleaker by the day. His personal life was too, when his money started running dry. The Germans were fed up. Thanks to the FBI's interference, he wasn't getting any work done. so his spy masters simply stopped paying him. As for the FBI, they continued to put Popoff's cover on the line in more ways than one. The Bureau had been sending codes to the Germans under his name in an attempt to root out the identities of German secret agents. When Popoff found out about this, he was horrified. If they botched the code, it would tip off his Nazi handlers that Agent Ivan had been compromised. He was right to worry. In March of 1942, a British radio command intercepted a dispatch from Berlin. It indicated that the Germans suspected Ivan of working for both sides. All agents were advised to take extreme care in dealing with Dushko Popoff. But the British didn't tell Popoff he'd been compromised. They were scared that their radio command station might be jeopardized if Popoff were interrogated about it down the line. Still, Popoff could sense something was up. Major von Kastoff kept asking for intel that he couldn't provide, and the FBI continued to prevent Popoff from working his way back into the Nazis' good graces. There was only one way out of this impossible bind: returning to Europe. In the summer of 1942, he asked his FBI handlers to let him return to Lisbon. He told them his failure in the United States required an explanation. The only way he could mend his broken relationship with the Abwehr was to meet them on their terms. The FBI agreed to let him go. Popoff was taking an enormous risk. If he failed to convince the Abwehr of his loyalties, his cover wouldn't just be blown. He would undoubtedly be left for dead. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday to finish up the story of double agent Dushko Popoff. For more information, amongst the many sources we used, we found Spy Counter Spy by Dushko Popoff and Into the Lion's Mouth by Larry Loftus extremely helpful. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Brian Golub, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Espionage was written by Justine Bede, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher. I'm Carter Roy.